Good morning, everyone. Is everyone awake and ready? Let us pray together. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, blessed Master, dearest Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only King, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. From the Vision magazine, an article by Swami Ramatirtha. Swami Ramatirtha came to America the early part of the 1900s. He was just a young boy, and his father had sent him to a guru. And in India, a guru teaches all the different arts. It teaches about spirituality, but also a young man would learn reading and writing and math. Mathematics and all the different sciences there. And so the father had intended for his son to go there to get some training and then to come back and take over the family business. Swami Ramatirtha became very enamored with the spiritual path and decided that was what he wanted more than anything else, so he decided to stay. His father wrote a very searing letter to the guru saying, I demand that you send my son back. And the son wrote back a letter and he says, your son has been sold as a slave to God, so don't ask for him back. He's not coming. And he is a wonderful saint. Both Swami Ramdas and Master had great love for his writings. This is entitled Criticism and Universal Love. Some make so much fuss about universal love, and yet keep the eyes riveted on the ugly points in the character of their protégés, hiding their inconsistency under the expression, you may hate the sin and love the sinner. Oh, dear people, you can never love anything so long as you perceive ugliness there. Love means perception of beauty. Fighting with darkness will never remove it. In a dark room, if we are throwing stones in all directions, striking the cudgel right and left, breaking down the panes, knocking over the table, upsetting the inkstand, and cursing and denouncing all the time, will it remove the darkness? Bring the light in, and darkness never was. So the negative, criticizing, chiding, discouraging process will not mend matters. All that is necessary is the positive, cheerful, hopeful, loving, encouraging attitude. If all the mud in the sewers is exposed in the streets, will it bring about any uplifting result? Never. So emphasizing the faults of others will not do any good. Let the flowing current of fresh water or peace and goodwill run over the sewer and all the dirt will be washed off. It is said that Akbar drew a line and asked his wise man, Birbal, to shorten the line without cutting or erasing it from any side. Akbar drew a line and asked his wise man, Birbal, to shorten the line without cutting or erasing it from any side. What would you do? It's a puzzle, huh? The latter drew a longer line parallel to it, and Akbar's line was shortened. So it is. Wisdom is to draw the longer line. Best criticism is to make people feel from within what you wish them to make them realize from without, just as Birbal convinced Akbar from within that his line was shortened. All grumbling is tantamount to, oh, why is the lily not an oak? Let us observe the beauty in each. Don't bark against the bad, but chant the beauties of the good. From all life's grapes, I press sweet wine. Isn't that wonderful? And how true it is. That little part of the mind, the nattering, that is always going on inside of our, oh, I like this, I don't like that, oh, I approve of this, and look at how that person dresses, and see how they talk, and see how they act, and it's just a constant commentary running, isn't it, on this world, on the people around it. And what that robs us from is the feeling of communion with God, because as long as that little part of the mind is constantly in monologue inside of our heads, we're not listening to that still, small voice. This comes from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, the Royal Science of God Realization. And the Bhagavad Gita verse comes from chapter 18, verse 9. O Arjuna, when dutiful action is performed solely because it should be done, forsaking attachment to it and its fruit, that renunciation is considered sattvic, or very good, divine. Obligatory actions are divinely ordained duties. They include the necessary caring for the body, nurturing of the mind, and the pleasurable duty of meditating on the soul, and also those selfless actions performed for the benefit of family, neighbors, and the world. The relinquishment of egoistic attachment to these actions and their fruits, while continuing to perform these righteous duties as obligatory because divinely ordained, it is the purest form of abandonment, sattvic renunciation. The devotee who remains in ecstatic communion with the soul, simultaneously watching the sensory and motor activities of the body without any desire or attachment, attains the highest or sattvic state of renunciation. Whether he is engaged in dutiful physical activities or is motionless in ecstatic meditation on the infinite, in his consciousness the divine presence is ever predominant. Feeling the boundless blessedness, he automatically renounces all attachment to lesser sensory attachments and pleasures, material objects, and fruits of actions. The automatic relinquishment of all else upon finding God is considered the supreme spiritual renunciation. The devotee who relinquishes lesser sense pleasures to gain the unknown bliss of God has entered the first stage of sattvic renunciation. The yogi who obtains the divine bliss and then consciously, deliberately, convincingly renounces all else has attained the ultimate state of perfect relinquishment. There's a story of a great king who is also a man of complete realization. And the story starts with a young boy who is really wanting to attain to his God realization. He goes to a nearby saint, and he asks him for instruction and to be his guru. The saint says, "My young son, I am not your guru. There is one who is greater than I, and he is your guru. You must go and seek him." And so the boy set off on a long trip in order to journey to where this Raj king, this king who was also a saint, a realized being, resided. And so he made his way, and finally he came to the palace. And as he entered into the palace, he saw that it was filled with riches, great works of art, gold, there were servants, and then he spied the king sitting on his throne. There were servants who were coming this way and that way, the king apparently busy with all the activities of head of state, and sitting on a large throne made out of gold, filled with cushions. And the boy thought to himself, this king can be no saint. Look it, he is surrounded in these riches. He is obviously taken up with the affairs of state. The saint who sent me here must have been wrong. Thinking in this manner, he turned around to leave. And as he is walking out, the king, who picked up on the thoughts of the boy, even though he was in the midst of activities, for he was truly a realized being, sent someone after him, one of his servants, and the servants encouraged the boy to come back and to talk to the king. And so the boy reluctantly returned, still ready to leave, and the king asked him, why did you come? The young boy said, I came for realization. Then the king said, why did you go? He said, you were so taken up with the affairs of state, all the activities, you're surrounded in all of these luxuries. He says, I deemed that you were not of a God-realized state. So the king began to engage the boy in conversation. And he said, I want you to sit here. And he had a cushion brought up, and they sat, and they just talked. And the king began to talk about God and about the path of realization. And he was swept up in the talk. And as they were talking in this manner, a servant came running. And he said, sire, can you smell the smoke? And the king said, no, I don't smell anything. He says, I'm talking about God. Never mind. Leave me alone. And he said, sire, there's a huge fire that's burning outside the palace. You must come and help organize the efforts to put it out. No, 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 said the king. I'm talking about God. I'm busy with my young friend here. Go and handle it yourselves. And so, as the fire continued to rage on, so did the king, feeling the upliftment in God consciousness, continue to talk about his most infinite beloved. And now the flames were lapping at the palace itself. The room was filling with smoke, and the servants continued to come. Sire, you must come. You must help us to organize the efforts to put this fire out. It will consume the entire palace. The king said, no, no, do not bother me. I am filled with God as I am speaking about him to this young sir. And so the flames continued to grow closer and closer, but the king was completely oblivious of it all. The boy had brought a few of his sacred books with him, and they were his only possessions. And as the flames came nearer, they became close to the books, and so he took the books and he moved them. And the flames continued to come, and the smoke was there, but the king seemed oblivious to it all. The boy was now near panic. He was hugging his books to his bosom. He was choking on the air that was filled with smoke. And yet the king just continued to talk about God. Now the king opened his eyes, and he looked at the boy. And he said, ah, he says, I see that you are attached to your books. You have picked them up. And you've hung them close, you've hugged them close to your bosom. He said, here am I in the midst of a palace which is said to be mine, and yet I'm oblivious to what is going on with it as it is being consumed in these flames. And suddenly the boy's eyes were opened. He saw that the few possessions that he had, he was very attached to, and yet the king was completely detached from everything. At that moment, it is said, that the king let out a long breath, and all the flames died down and went out, and everything was extinguished, and eventually everything was rebuilt. But the king, in the midst of it all, had shown that he was completely absent of attachment. Is it possible to live in this world in such a state of detachment? And the answer is yes. It is. There are many in India, and there are some in the West, who enter into such a life to gain such detachment and such realization. by renouncing everything that they have. They leave home, they leave family, they leave all things that we normally look to keep us safe, to make us feel secure in this life. And they may wander from here to there. In India, the sadhus will spend no more than 3 days at any one place, unless it's during the monsoon season, then they're allowed to hold up someplace for a longer period of time. But other than that, they are constantly on the move, because it is thought that if they stay more than 3 days, they'll begin to form some attachments to the people there. Their ideal is to become completely detached. And they do this by renouncing everything in this world. But we follow a different path. We follow the path of the householder yogi. And Lari Mahasya was the one who entered into family life. When he first met Babaji and was initiated, his first impulse was to leave his family, to stay there with Babaji, whom he had become reunited with, and in whom he realized this was his guru of many lifetimes, and whom he felt such great love for. And he wanted to just forget about all of his outer life, about business, about family, everything, and just remain there, and to become immersed in the divine consciousness. Now, he came as a completely realized soul. And so when he was awakened by Babaji, he entered directly into his divine consciousness. And yet he wanted to remain there only. He didn't want to go back out in the world, but Babaji asked him to, said that it was his destiny to remain with his family, to fulfill the obligations that the world gave him in terms of business, in terms of family, all the kind of normal things we think of as living in this world, to enter back into that world, but retain with him the divine consciousness. And this he did. He went on to father the children, to have a home, to continue in the business. He was a type of accountant in the office where he worked there. And he continued on that way until he entered into retirement years. And even in retirement years, he didn't have enough money to be able to maintain the family, so he also did tutoring during that time to help supplement his income at that time. So he worked through much of his life in this way. And still, he remained in that divine consciousness, and as he became established in that divine consciousness, he was able to do all the things that you need to do in this world. And yet he remained in the state of detachment. Yeah, there's a story that is somewhat humorous that was embarrassing to him at the time, that he went to the bank in order to make a transition. And as he was sitting there on the bank, he became immersed in the divine consciousness. There are times when divine consciousness comes on you, and it draws you inwardly just like a huge magnet, and you feel that draw going in. And as he sat on the bench waiting for his turn, he was drawn in such a way. Now, the manager of the bank knew something about Lari Mahasya. You know, he would look the same as anybody else. They just saw this elderly gentleman sitting on the bench. But he knew about him. He knew about his exalted spiritual status. And perhaps only as in India, but he told the other clerks, "No, we can't disturb him." And it came time for closing the bank. And they closed the doors, but they all sat around and they waited. And the manager of the bank explained to all the clerks there, "It is a great blessing for us to be able to sit with such a great master when he's in a divine absorption such as this." And eventually, Lari Mahasya came out of this state. He had not been aware of his outer surroundings. He had not been aware of the passage of time. But when he opened his eyes, he saw all the clerks and the bank manager sitting around him. He saw that it was late, that it had gotten dark outside, and he was very embarrassed because he hadn't meant to keep any of these gentlemen from going home to their dinners and to their families. And they did the transaction for him, even though the bank was officially closed, and he went on his way. He had such an ability and such a draw to go inward in this way. He could be in a busy place like that and felt himself in complete absorption in divine consciousness. Now, what is this divine consciousness? It is bliss absolute. It is an existence that goes beyond the five senses of the body. It lifts you up into a higher consciousness that is beyond this body. And it makes you know that you are one with the divine essence that is the author of everything that is. It is a tremendous state of consciousness. Now, the fact that not everybody experiences this consciousness does not mean that it is not true, nor does it mean that it is not available to all. It resides within us, and for the most people, it resides in a latent state. It is a possibility, but it remains as only a possibility as long as the individual does not feel a strong and compelling desire to become uplifted in that divine consciousness. When we feel that kind of desire come into our hearts and to our souls, we want that kind of realization. We want to go beyond the limitations of what we have experienced so far. And when that desire is very keen and very strong, then God arranges for a teacher, a guru, to come into our lives, to help awaken us to that divine consciousness. The guru serves as an example, if they are what they should be, because they reside in that divine consciousness already. And therefore, it's like putting a log that is drenched with water and putting that log next to a flaming log, one that is fully engulfed in flames. And as that log that is drenched continues to reside next to the flaming log, gradually that drenched log begins to dry out. It first hisses and then it steams and it goes through lots of different phases. But gradually it becomes dry timber. And as it becomes very dry, then a spark leaps from the flaming log to the log that had been all water-soaked and waterlogged. And now that flame can catch fire, and it begins to burn, and it engulfs that log. Now, unlike a material log, the log of the soul does not get consumed by the flame. Rather, it gets purified. Everything that is representing untruth, darkness, becomes completely consumed within those flames. And now that log is glowing brightly with the divine light. It has become completely consumed in that light. Now, does that mean that the individual becomes extinct, dead, no longer existent? Not at all. It is a rebirth. Jesus said that you have to be born twice. You're born of water and born of spirit. Now, born of water is the material birth. It is the birth of the mother being in the amniotic fluid. And you're born into this world. And that is a necessary thing to have happen in your journey to realization. But then comes the second birth. And just like the first birth, it is oftentimes of a long duration in its coming. There's a gradual formation of the divine being within you. Now, it's not that the divine being didn't exist in you already, but for the consciousness to be properly prepared to receive that divine consciousness, to begin to manifest it, That is what needs preparation. Your mind, your attitude. And just like Ramatirtha talked about, everybody talks about loving another person, loving your neighbor as yourself, loving God. And yet, as soon as they walk out of the church, they're thinking this critical thought and that critical thought. They're full of fears, they're full of desire natures that take them far from that loving kind of consciousness. It is a discipline in the beginning to learn how to love, to learn how to see the beauty within other people, within all situations. We don't see it at first. We see those people who are perhaps cruel. We see those people who irritate us. We see people who are perhaps unkind. And we live in reaction to this world. We live in reaction to other people. If somebody loves us, then it is easy for us to love them back. But what if they hate us? What if they abuse us? What if they despise us? What if they ignore us? Do we find it so easy to love that one? And the answer is obviously no. It takes a greater effort to find the beauty in someone who is not manifesting that beauty. Now, how do we find beauty in someone who is manifesting something ugly? And the answer is that we look beyond the obvious. We look beyond the surface. We look beyond the ugliness that that person is manifesting. Somewhere deep inside is a divine manifestation, is a soul, that it is pure. Before there was original sin, as is talked about, there was original innocence. And within every person, there is original innocence. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita said that fire cannot burn it. That is the essential soul within a person, that perfection, that purity, that beauty. That water cannot drown it. That nothing can change it or destroy it. And that is the soul that is within you. And no matter what you may have done in your past, no matter what crimes you may have committed, what mistakes you have made along the way, you cannot damage or change or kill the soul that is within you, that perfection, the ultimate and supreme self within you. Now, it may get layered over with many layers of darkness that obscures it from your vision and your knowledge. But it is always residing within you. It is even in this moment. And as St. John said in the first of his testament, that to all them who received him, that is the inner light, the inner Christ within you, to them gave he power to become sons of God. We are born into this world as sons of men. But we take a second birth and we become sons of God. That is children of God. That is, we realize that we are made up of the same form and substance that the divine being who created us in the first place is also made up of. If God created everything, and there is nothing that has been created without that divine agency, then we must reason that everything in its essence is of divine origin. It is made up of God stuff. And that includes you, and it includes your neighbor, and it includes every God-blessed thing that you see. But your eyes have become blind to the divine nature that is in everyone and everything, including yourself. So you begin to turn your mind within. You begin to turn your mind toward that light, because it is only the light, as Ramatirtha said. You don't get the light by criticizing, by finding the darkness, by looking at the darkness and everything that is. You only remove the darkness by bringing the light into the room. There is the story of the room that was engulfed in darkness for 1,000 years. And during that 1,000 years, it seemed as if darkness reigned supreme, that nothing could challenge it, And one day, the window crashed open, that which had barred the light from coming in, and now the light streamed into the room. And at the moment that the light streamed in, the darkness disappeared. The darkness seemed to be the unchallenged, the invincible ruler of that room until the moment the light came in. And in that moment, darkness fled and had absolutely no power and no existence as the light flooded the room. And the same is true with your soul. The moment the window opens to your divine being, the light comes flooding in, and darkness has no power. It has no existence within you once that light has illuminated your inner temple. This does not happen in a day. It is something that we strive for. It is something that we work for. It is our spiritual practice, our sadhana, that brings us to that moment when the light will come in. But it is what we are born for. And we look at the things we do in this world, and there's so much we're willing to commit to everything else, our entertainment, the things that we want, we're willing to work and sacrifice for all of these things that have such a momentary pleasure. For a moment it's here and then it's gone. But what are we willing to do to discover that divine essence within us? And the sad commentary is, for many of us, very, very little. We can't even be bothered with a half an hour in the morning and a half an hour at night to meditate and to pray. We can't be bothered even with that much. And yet, there is riches and a kingdom and a tremendous awareness that is just waiting for you, crying for you to be awakening to it. And we can barely give it a glance, barely give it a second thought. We're so preoccupied with the little things of this world. As we begin to renounce this world inwardly, it just simply means that we're not completely consumed by it. Now, we feel that there is a divine life awakening in us. We feel a presence inside of us that is something beyond us and yet intimately connected to us. It is that divine presence, and as we focus our mind more and more on that divine presence, the light within us, the more darkness has no power over us. We simply enter into this world to do the things that are required of us. But what we're really interested in, what we're really focused on, is that divine presence and keeping it going. Awakening it, letting it take over our whole beings, and with it comes bliss, comes a divine love, a universal love for one thing and all, and a wisdom, a knowledge of how to proceed. Move this way and not that way. And we surrender to this inward life that is beginning to express itself in us. Like a spring day, it begins to blossom inside of us. And we feel a renewed life, an expanded life, a joyful life, a blissful life. And now that spring day continues on and on as we feel that divine presence now is a constant feature, always within the background or the foreground. But whatever we are doing, we have that awareness that the divine life is ever percolating through us, feeding our souls, guiding us. And now we see this world as the divine Leela, as a play. And it's just something that we enter into. Have you ever sat in the audience during a play? And you see the stage, and now the stage becomes lit, and actors come on it, and you're interested in it, but you're also an observer of it. And now you enter into life in such a way. You see this as a stage setting when you open these two eyes, and you enter in, and you find the different people who are inhabiting the stage setting. And it is all a divine play. Each one are actors guided by the divine. And therefore you're not attached to things as being this way or that. You're simply playing your part to the best of your ability, attuned to that divine consciousness, the divine scriptwriter. Now joy and love bubble out through your heart and your soul. Enlightenment shines from every aspect of your consciousness and being. You realize that this is the real purpose for which you were born, to find this second birth, a noble birth, a divine birth. And whatever it has so-called cost you in terms of effort, in terms of turning away from the things of this world, whatever has cost you seems as nothing compared with the divine bliss now that you experience. Oh, my friends, if you could but know that divine bliss, you would see how pale the things of this world pale into insignificance. They just simply do not hold the center stage any longer. And you do them because the divine life within you prompts you to do them. I've been reading a wonderful book that was sent to me from India, Anandi Moy Ma, A Goddess Among Us. And I had met the author. He was a Brahmacharya, one who was wanting to become a Swami, when I was there in Anandashram. And he had been a disciple of Anandi Moy Ma, and he's the one who has written this book. And he's a wonderful soul. He continues to live there in India. And I thought I would read to you from a short chapter, The Kumbh Mela of Haridwar. In 1938, Ma and her devotees attended the great religious gathering, the Kumbh Mela, at Haridwar. Every day, Bolanath was her husband in this lifetime. He is a very highly advanced being. Would take a large group of kirtan singers into the city, chanting the holy name of God in the streets. His striking appearance and the fervor of his devotion always attracted a crowd, and many pilgrims would join the group and take up the refrain of the chant. During the Kumbh Mela, there were certain astrological periods when bathing in the holy Ganges River is considered very auspicious. On one such day, Bolanath went down to the bathe in the Ganga. To his surprise, the large gathering of sadhus assembled there received him with great reverence and ritually bathed him with their own hands. When Ma was told of this, she commented, "Bolanath lives in self-forgetfulness, but the sadhus recognized his spiritual greatness." At this time, Bolanath made and took the formal vows of sannyas. Shortly after leaving Haridwar, Bolanath contracted smallpox and was taken to recuperate at the Dehradun ashram. For fear of infection, Ma ordered most of the inmates away and personally nursed Bolanath to the very end. After seeking Ma's forgiveness for any mistake he may have inadvertently committed in her service, he addressed her as Ma, and while she held his hand, she held her hand at the top of his head, he passed away under her protection. Later, when asked why she didn't seem to grieve over the loss of her husband, she replied, "How can I grieve? I can see clearly where the soul is and where it has gone." And this is the absolute truth, that with the inner vision, we have no doubts as to where the soul is or where it has gone. And when we see in this manner and we feel in this manner, then how can there be any great grieving over the passing of a soul? We know that that individual has passed on to a greater life. And particularly in a higher advanced soul like Bolanath, he goes into the complete and absolute freedom of spirit. But for those who have not developed themselves so far, they enter into the astral realms, which are beautiful and much more closely attuned to the divine vibration than here on earth. And so even there, we see for those individuals a wonderful birth, a birth into a new life. It is not an end to life. That is the material mind that thinks so. And it is when we see this life only with material eyes do we see that it is the end of things, not the beginning. With each ending is a fresh new beginning. Isn't this what nature teaches us? That when we see fall time coming and the tree drops the leaves and it enters into a dormancy and it stays that way throughout the winter, and then the spring comes and a new awakening, a new birth comes, new leaves come out on the tree, the sap begins to roll again and come up through all the different branches. And the beauty of spring is wonderful. And when we can see life in its totality, we don't begrudge it any of the seasons. We see that all the seasons are necessary, so that in birth, in growth, in attainment to maturity, in passing into old age, and then ultimately what we call death, all of these things are good and necessary stages. They're all a part of life. And when we're able to stand back as witnesses and watch all these various stages of life occurring, not overly attached to the comings and the goings, because we know that they are all temporary. None of us are buyers here on earth. We're all renters, huh? But we think that we're buyers. We think this is absolute. We think this is the end. And it's not true. That is our mistake. And it is our false attachment that gives us such suffering and misery. When you enter upon this spiritual path, take with you your all. Bring your all to it. Really delve deep into the divine consciousness. Don't be satisfied with just a little here, just a little there. There are those who attain a certain level of consciousness, and delusion takes over and makes them self-satisfied. It makes them think that they've gone as far as they're going to go. But, you know, we really need to understand the infinite nature of God. And when realized saints come into their complete and full realization, they don't have less love or less idea about their teachers or about their gurus, about those who helped them along the way. They don't divorce themselves from them. It's not that they have to remain around them all the time, because they are now freed beings. But they have greater love for them, greater appreciation for them, because it is through their agency that we have been able to find our realization, our freedom. And so the love and gratitude grows in greater measures. It's not unlike the parent who raises the child, but the child doesn't always appreciate everything the parent has to go through. But when that child comes into adulthood and then has their own children, they begin to really appreciate what their parents did with a finer sense of it, because they see all the things that a parent has to go through. And now they understand their parents in a new way. And so as you enter into realization, you understand the guru in a new and different way, because your own divine consciousness is informing you about all the things that the guru has gone through in order to help give birth to the inner Christ within yourself. Let this be the dawning of a new day, a dawning of a day of realization, a dawning of a greater intensification towards your own realization, Take the name of God, chant God's name, whatever name appeals to you most, for all names are God's names. For where is he not? Do it with all the love and devotion within your heart. Purify your life, heart, mind, body, soul, until you become so attuned to the divine vibration that you are just positively quivering with that divine vibration, even as a guitar string might quiver with its vibration. And you radiate that light out to this world. You become a blessing to this world. And you truly love this world as you were designed to love it. Be this true now and forevermore. May the Masters and the infinite divine light and life ever bless you, ever awaken itself within you, ever inspire you to seek out greater and greater realization until that light, that flame, has so consumed everything that is not of God that there is nothing left but the divine light and the divine life. And you will know such freedom, such beauty, that you will drop down on your knees in such gratitude for everything that God has done for you. Be it so from now forward. Will you please pray with me? O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he. Within you all.